This is the Clinical Pharmacology Podcast with Nathan Tuescher, where I discuss clinical pharmacology and pharmacometrics topics from the perspective of drug development scientists. I want to thank everyone who's reached out to me in the weeks after I started this podcast. Your kind words mean the world to me. Thank you, thank you, thank you. The topic for this episode was suggested by Drew, and I really appreciate Drew reaching out to me and asking about this. So I'm going to discuss bioequivalent studies and generic drug development. Generic drug development is generally based on the idea that similar exposure to the same active ingredient will lead to a similar clinical response. Thus, once an active ingredient's patent life expires, other manufacturing companies can create generic versions of a drug. These generic versions must show similar pharmacokinetic exposure levels to the innovator's product to gain approval. The bioequivalence clinical study is the method of choice for generic drug development. However, these studies are also used in other situations to compare drug exposure. For example, if an innovator wants to change the oral formulation of an approved drug, they will run a bioequivalence study to demonstrate that pharmacokinetic exposure is similar between the currently approved and the proposed new formulations. So this discussion is relevant across all types of drug development. I will refer to guidance documents from both the European Medicines Agency, or EMA, and the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, or FDA, in today's podcast. Also, I may use the abbreviation BE for bioequivalence throughout this podcast. The EMA has a guideline of the investigations of bioequivalence dated January 2010. The FDA has three different guidance documents, one regarding bioequivalence studies with pharmacokinetic endpoints for drugs submitted under an ANDA dated August 2021. The second and third have the same title because one version was published in January 2001, and an updated revision is in draft form as of December 2022. That guidance is titled Statistical Approaches to Establishing Bioequivalence. My discussion will focus on the updated draft version rather than the one from 2001. I will point out differences between the EMA and FDA recommendations when they are relevant. First, I'll start off with a discussion of the definition of bioequivalence, or BE. Then I will discuss the statistical basis for bioequivalence and how you can leverage that for study design. And I'll end with some unique challenges related to bioequivalence. Throughout, I will give practical suggestions based on my experiences in the past with BE studies. Bioequivalence, or BE, is a term created by the pharmaceutical industry to describe two medicinal products that have the same active ingredient and their bioavailabilities after single and multiple doses are similar within acceptable predefined limits. Both medicinal products should have the same rate of absorption and the same extent of absorption to be considered bioequivalent. In general, one formulation is considered the reference formulation. This is usually the innovator marketed product, or it could be the formulation used in a phase 3 testing, but not planned on being the market image formulation. The other formulation is called the test formulation. This is the one we're testing to see if it's bioequivalent to the reference formulation. This is where you'll get the terms test and reference for bioequivalent studies. The idea of bioequivalence is derived from the principle that once a drug enters the systemic circulation, it doesn't care or remember anything about the formulation from whence it came. Thus, the components of the formulation are only there to facilitate absorption into the systemic circulation. Therefore, if we measure the systemic exposure after administration of two different formulations, we can be certain that the systemic PK parameters like clearance and volume distribution will be identical between the two formulations. However, the bioavailability, that's the fraction of the drug that's actually absorbed into the systemic circulation, and the absorption rate constants, the rate at which the drug gets into the systemic circulation, could be different between the formulations. Thus, bioequivalence testing evaluates if the values for the rate and extent of absorption are similar between the two formulations. However, instead of trying to fit pharmacokinetic models to the individual patients and then comparing the parameter estimates for bioavailability and for Ka, clever use of non-compartmental PK parameters was developed instead as an option that's much more efficient, cheaper to do, and actually, I believe, more accurate. What this means in practice is that the pharmacokinetic parameters Cmax and AUC for the two products must be similar within an acceptable range. I'll discuss the statistical details of the acceptable range in the next section of the podcast. But both the FDA and EMA guidance documents require that both the rate and extent of absorption match to achieve bioequivalence. The AUC, or area under the curve, is the best measure for the extent of absorption. This is because it reflects the total amount of drug that has been absorbed from the dosage. The Cmax can reflect both the rate and the extent of absorption. If the extent is the same, the Cmax should be the same. But if the rate of absorption is a bit faster than for the test than the reference, the Cmax could be higher. And if the rate of absorption for the test is a bit slower than the reference, the Cmax could be lower. So the Cmax is actually sensitive to both the rate and the extent of absorption, while the AUC is really only sensitive to the extent of absorption. Most bioequivalent studies are conducted using a crossover rather than a parallel design. This means that each subject receives one dose of each formulation. The crossover design has the advantage that each subject serves as his or her own control. Thus, you can calculate the change in Cmax or AUC for each individual patient, and then compare the overall differences across subjects. This reduces the variability in the calculations and generally allows for more precision with fewer subjects. Some BE studies require parallel designs due to practical issues. For example, if the drug requires 14 days for a complete washout, it may be more reasonable to conduct a parallel study rather than housing people in a clinic for almost 28 days. These studies should always be randomized and blinded, meaning subjects should be randomly assigned to each treatment in each period, and neither subjects nor the clinical staff should know which formulation is being administered. This is a method of reducing bias in the results. A quick story about bias in clinical studies. I worked at a job where we collaborated with a phase one clinical unit, and we noticed that the physicians would change the subject numbers right before the doses were administered. When we investigated, the physician said something like this, and I'm paraphrasing, "I want to choose the healthiest looking participant to be the first to take the drug in case something goes wrong. So I decided who looks like the strongest, healthiest person, and then I change them to number one. And then I renumber the rest of the subjects based on my perception of their health status." In essence, this physician was injecting his bias into every single clinical study. The randomization is designed to avoid bias. Don't change subject numbers ever in any clinical study. And don't run unrandomized bioequivalence trials. Regulators will almost certainly ignore the results of a non-randomized bioequivalence study. BE studies are commonly run with the highest dosage strength available and under fasting conditions. In some cases, additional scenarios are included, such as multiple dosing, administering drug in the presence of food, or even using subjects in specific age ranges. So you can refer to the guidance documents for a lot of those specific details, which are going to be specific to your drug product and to the target patient population that you're going after. Now that we have defined bioequivalence, let's talk about the word similar. Nearly all statistical tests were designed to tell you if two values are the same with some degree of certainty. For example, a t-test will tell you if the mean of two groups are the same or different. While this might seem like it could work for BE studies, it won't. And let me walk you through an example of why it won't. Imagine the mean Cmax for the reference formulation was 100 nanograms per mil with a standard deviation of 0.8 nanograms per mil. The mean Cmax for the test formulation was 103 nanograms per mil with a standard deviation of 0.7 nanograms per mil. A t-test would indicate that these mean values 100 and 103 are statistically different, with a p-value less than 0.0001 or 1/10,000th. So these numbers are only 3% different, but they are statistically significantly different from one another. But from a clinical perspective, a 3% difference in drug exposure is very unlikely to cause any clinical difference in response, either for efficacy or safety. In fact, running a BE study with the same formulation as a test and a reference, sorry, the same formulation as the test and the reference, could result in a 3% difference in exposure just due to random chances. So a different test is needed. The method selected for bioequivalence studies is called the 2-1-sided test procedure. It is also now just called average bioequivalence. This test takes the ratio of the averages of the PK parameters Cmax and AUC for the test and reference formulations. Then it calculates the 90% confidence interval for that ratio. If the 90% confidence interval falls completely within appropriate limits, then the two formulations are deemed to be bioequivalent. So let me walk you through the calculation using those same numbers that I used for the t-test. Using the same values for Cmax, the ratio of test to reference is 103%, which is 103 divided by 100 times 100%. The 90% confidence interval for that ratio is 102 to 104%. Because the 90% confidence interval is completely contained within the range of 80 to 125%, these two formulations would be considered bioequivalent. So can you see the difference in a t-test? We're saying that the means are different from each other. That's true. But in the 2-1-sided test procedure, we're saying the difference between those is likely not going to cause a biological difference. So they're bioequivalent. They're equivalent within a biological range. And that biological range is that 80 to 125. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit more about that range and how we come up with it later. But that's the difference between this statistical test. You want the range to be within a biologically acceptable margin, not the actual mean values to be identical to one another. So there's three numbers that we calculate in the bioequivalence calculation. Two are really important, and then one is moderately important. The first one is called the point estimate, or the ratio of the test formulation exposure metric divided by the reference formulation exposure metric. This is the average ratio across all subjects in the study. Think of this as the difference between mean values. This value is usually reported as the difference between formulations, but honestly, it's not used in the assessment of bioequivalence in nearly all cases. The 90% confidence interval for that mean value is calculated based on the variability in those individual ratios of test to reference. This gives us an estimate of the range in point estimates that we could see if we were to run the BE study hundreds of more times. The ratio, or that point estimate, would likely be between the lower and upper limit in 90% of those studies. Those values are the 102 and 104% ratios in the example that we just discussed. Now, to decide on bioequivalence, we compare those values to the accepted limits. The default limit is 80 to 125%. This was determined based on an assumption that a 20% increase or a 20% decrease in exposure is not likely to be clinically meaningful for most drugs. This 20% number was completely arbitrary, but over the past 20 years, it has served us quite well. If you're wondering why the range isn't 80 to 120%, it's because we log transform the exposure metrics prior to analysis. And when you take plus or minus 20% on the log scale and then back transform to the normal scale, you get 80 to 125%. So if the lower and the upper limits of your 90% confidence interval for the ratio of test to reference are between 80 and 125%, you can claim bioequivalence. In some cases, different acceptable ranges can be used. For example, plus or minus 30% would yield an acceptable range of 70 to 143%. And plus or minus 10% would be 90 to 111%. These alternate ranges can be based on other safety or efficacy data, or they can be used for highly variable drug products that exhibit very high within-subject or intra-subject variability. In most cases, alternate ranges require prior agreement from the regulatory authorities. Details of the calculation method is included in both the EMA and FDA guidance documents. But a few more important notes are that the exposure values should be log transformed before calculation of the ratio. The result must then be back transformed to get the point estimates and the 90% confidence interval. This is equivalent to calculating the geometric mean of the untransformed exposure values. Because the statistical test for bioequivalence is well defined, we can also calculate the power of a specific clinical study designed to show bioequivalence. The power calculation requires the following. First, an estimate of the difference between the test and reference formulation. Second, an estimate of the within-subject variability. Third, the acceptable limits for the 90% confidence interval. Fourth, the number of subjects. And fifth, the study design. All of these numbers are easy to obtain, with the exception of the estimate of within-subject variability. But that number is available, and there's a great lecture by Helmut Schütz available online that shows how you can get the estimate from published study data. I'll put a link in the show notes to his lecture. So once you have these five values, the difference, the within-subject variability, the acceptable limits, the number of subjects, and the study design, meaning parallel or crossover, you can use a statistical package to calculate the power. I like a package called PowerTOST, Power T-O-S-T in R, to do the calculations. As you increase the number of subjects, you'll see the power increase. And as you decrease the number of subjects, you'll see the power decrease. The power is the probability that the test will correctly reject the null hypothesis. So we normally target a power of 80% with a type 1 error or alpha value of 0.05. I'll leave a link in the show notes to the PowerTOST R package so that you can download it and try it for yourself. This analysis for bioequivalence is also used to evaluate many other things in pharmaceutical development. The evaluation of food effects, whether or not drug-drug interactions are clinically significant, if drug transporter interactions are clinically significant, comparison of exposures between different groups, such as race and sex, and many more situations. Essentially, if you want to compare pharmacokinetic exposure between two discrete groups or items, you can use the BE statistical methodology. It's a very handy thing to understand and leverage in any development program. I've successfully used this method to leverage available clinical data and avoid running additional clinical trials requested by regulatory authorities. I've also used this methodology to help set up sample size determinations for future studies. Understanding how to perform this calculation will help you immensely throughout your career. So let's move on to some potential challenges you may find with BE studies. The sampling schedule is very important in any BE study. In most cases, you want to implement a rich sampling scheme with at least 10 to 15 blood samples for each subject for each dosing profile. I usually recommend 3 samples between dose administration and the expected Tmax. 3 more samples immediately following Tmax, and then evenly spread out 6 to 9 more samples with the last 1 to 2 samples expected to be below the limit of quantitation. This should give you a complete profile with adequate coverage for the absorption phase, or Cmax, and the terminal elimination phase. When in doubt, add another sample. It'll likely be worth it so that you don't have to run the study again. It is also very important to ensure a complete washout between periods. If you're using a crossover design, this is critical. I usually recommend at least 7 half-lives between the first and second doses. But half-life really only makes sense with a drug that exhibits one compartment kinetics. The better option is to simulate exposures with a PK model and then identify the time at which concentrations fall below the lower limit of quantitation and then add another 12 to 24 hours to that time before administering the next dose. If you can manage a crossover study, even if the in-clinic stays are long, you will get less variable results. So what I mean by a PK model is you can just take a mean concentration time profile and fit it to a PK model. Maybe it fits a two-compartment model. And then you simulate out the concentrations for a long time and you determine the time at which the predicted concentration is less than the lower limit of quantitation of your analytical assay. Take that time, add 12, 24, maybe even 48 hours to it, and then that will tell you how long you need to separate your first and second doses. And to test it, you could actually go back and fit a few individual subjects, and I'd choose maybe a couple subjects that had the latest measurable time points and see if that washout would have been adequate for those subjects. Some drugs may require you to calculate a partial AUC and provide comparisons of those values. These are usually done in the absorption phase and are a more accurate way of capturing the rate of drug absorption than Cmax alone. If you're required to do that, you may benefit by oversampling in the absorption phase. For example, if you have to provide the AUC from 0 to 4 hours, you may want to have samples at 0, 1, 2, 3, 3.5, and 4 hours post-dose. The more samples you have in that period, the less likely it is that one extreme concentration will cause problems for you in your partial AUC calculation. If you are involved in generic drug development, leverage the information provided by the FDA. You can review published information from the innovator on their products, on the pharmacokinetics, and you can get nice estimates of Cmax, AUC, and the within subject variability of each parameter if you listen to the presentation that I'll link in my show notes. Also, the FDA provides product-specific guidance documents that outline any unique or special study requirements. Use these to know what studies you have to run and the recommendations from the Office of Generic Drugs who will be reviewing your application. I've put a link to the FDA's product-specific guidance documents in the show notes. And this is one that in my career early on, I knew about generic drug development, I knew generic companies, I knew bioequivalents, but I had no idea that the FDA produced these product-specific guidance documents until somebody told me. So I hope you can go and look there now, and it'll be amazing how many documents that the Office of Generic Drugs provides guidance on and what it is going to require for you to get an ANDA approved. These can also be useful for companies that are doing different drug development, for example, a 505B2 approach where they're using the innovator's systemic exposure, but they have a different route of administration or different method of administration, and they can understand what the expectations are going to be for equivalence. Some drugs have high variability in PK parameters, which is defined as a within subject variability greater than 30%. What this usually means is you can give the same product to the same individual, and their AUC and Cmax might differ by 30%. This is often, but not always, often due to very low absolute bioavailability, but it can happen for other reasons. The EMA and the FDA guidance documents outline recommendations for highly variable products. The recommendations differ a little bit. Neither one is better than the other, but I really encourage you, if you have a drug like that, to read those guidance documents. But if you really have a product like that you're working on, seek out an expert in bioequivalent studies and hopefully find one that has worked on high variable drugs before and bioequivalents, because they're going to give you fantastic advice and help you succeed the first time. Finally, a story from early in my career that it's about bioequivalence, but it's not about generic drugs. So I was working on a drug that had a relatively long half-life, and it was administered by subcutaneous injection. So the phase 3 study was ongoing, and the development team decided that the formulation used in that study was not going to be the best option for the go-to-market formulation. So in the study, they were using single-use vials for daily injections, and they wanted to market a multi-use pen that could administer 28 injections. So we decided we have to run a bioequivalent study to compare single-use injections to the multi-use pen, because we were not going to run more efficacy studies with a multi-use pen. The formulation and clinical team members working on the study with me thought this would be very straightforward and not very difficult because the formulation content was the same. So no formulation components were different. Everything was exactly the same. The only difference was single-use injectors versus a multi-use injector. But my mentor and I were much more concerned because we had seen a lot of variability in Cmax in previous clinical studies, and we weren't really sure about the source of that variability. In addition, we knew that needle lengths were different between the multi-use injector and the single-use injections. And because of the long half-life, we also knew we had to run a parallel study. So we can see the challenges for this statistical test piling up, but our colleagues only saw the clinical aspects or the chemistry aspects of the formulation. So we actually increased the sample size because we only wanted to run this study one time. And my memory is that we had well over 150 subjects per arm in this bioequivalence trial. Now, for reference, most bioequivalence studies are run with maybe 12 to 36 subjects. I have never been involved in one with over 100 except for this one study. So we ran the study at a fantastic clinic, and this clinic actually dosed all 300 or 320, I don't remember the exact number, of subjects in just a few days. And we wanted to minimize the number of groups, the number of dosing events, and so this clinic did just a fabulous job recruiting all these people. And we hoped that we could show bioequivalence with this, but the data did not support bioequivalence. The variability in Cmax was much greater than we had imagined, and we actually felt there was no way to run a successful bioequivalence study. So this study, it was very early in my career, helped me learn of the real complexities and unknowns for bioequivalence studies. In this case, I think we did everything right, yet the study failed to show bioequivalence. So BE studies can be very challenging, but in many cases, you can mitigate those challenges through thoughtful planning ahead of time. Great. Thank you, Drew, for suggesting this topic. He specifically wanted to know about power calculations for bioequivalent studies, but I thought it was better to talk about the guidance documents and everything goes around it in addition to those power calculations. So let me summarize what I discuss today about these BE studies and generic drug development. So I reviewed what bioequivalence is and how it is used in both generic drug development and for formulation changes with innovator drug companies. I walked through the statistical basis of bioequivalence and explained the difference between the T-test and the two one-sided tests that we now use to establish bioequivalence. I reviewed how to calculate power for your upcoming BE study, along with a tool that you can use in those calculations. And lastly, I discussed some challenges with bioequivalent studies and potential approaches you might use to mitigate them. So links to all the guidance documents and the other tools I mentioned today are included in the show notes. And you can also get those emailed to you by subscribing to my newsletter at tushersolutions.com. And finally, thank you all for listening and sending me feedback on this podcast and sending me ideas of things to talk about. I've gotten so many ideas, I can't possibly get all the ideas into, you know, the next 5 or 6 upcoming episodes, but I'm going to work to include as many of them as I can. But I really appreciate you listening, and I hope you have a wonderful day. For more information, please connect with me on LinkedIn, send me an email to nathan@tushersolutions.com, or sign up for my newsletter at tushersolutions.com/newsletter. The newsletter is a copy of the show notes sent to your email each time an episode is released. Also, please subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to the show. Thank you.